Baseball has had many players who've been great at one thing. My guest, Willie Mays, is one of those rarest of greats. During his 22 years as a major leaguer, he was exceptional at all facets of the game. Slugging, running, fielding, throwing. In general, an all-round spectacular player. Some say the best. Mays retired at the end of the 1973 season with nearly 3,000 games and 660 home runs under his belt. After he retired, he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame the first year he was eligible. That's an honor that's only been given to a handful of players. Willie Mays has just written his autobiography. It's called Say Hey, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Willie Mays, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, man.
You spent most of your life out in center field, and I'm curious about what you liked, what it was like out there, what you liked about it.
Well, I think you have it all wrong. I didn't spend my life in center field. I was a player in center field, but my life was involved at the other eight players. And I think when you do that, I think sometimes people that doesn't know about baseball get it all wrong. I was one of the type of guys that had to worry about eight guys. So in center field, I was more just a player. I was involved in like a manager or whatever, you know, involvement.
Well, you I know, describe center field as a kind of playground or backyard, that you talked about it as a kind of backyard. And obviously it was a place where center field is where someone has to be able to run.
Yeah, center field
and cover a lot of territory.
Center field have to be a guy that want to move, want to just about catch all the balls involved there. And I played in ballparks like the Polo Ground, which was a big center field, and I loved it. Then I went to San Francisco. I had at the beginning I had a short center field. Then they built a big one so I could run a little bit. And I think most guys that you see play center field are quick guys. I mean, quick or fast, and want to do a lot of things. The left field and right field are so-so guys. They're the guys who want to cover the line. And I think the center field, he's got to cover everything. You know.
Well, now, in high school, you played for the Birmingham Black Barons, which was in the Negro League.
Yes.
And obviously it was a time when there were separate black and white baseball leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how different it was. And you describe some of what you had to contend with because you were in a country that was very segregated at the time.
And well, it's still segregated in certain ways, you know. But when I came along, we had our own league in Birmingham. We had about 16 teams in different cities, Kansas City, Memphis, Little Rock, Philadelphia. Philadelphia had a thing called Philadelphia Stars here. And we had our own little World Series in Chicago during the All-Star break. But it didn't bother me because I played when I was 14, so I didn't bother me just being, you know, segregated or whatever. But when I came to Trenton, New Jersey, I had a little bit of that in my first, week, because Jacket had already came in 1947, so it had to begin to loosen up a little bit when I came, you know, came to the Giants. But the only problem I had was in Hagerstown, Maryland, and it wasn't really a big problem. It's just some name calling, which I had already been programmed for that, and it wasn't that bad because by Sunday coming, I had already got about 9 or 10 hits, so they didn't bother me anymore.
You know. You were about 16 when Jackie Robinson broke into the majors. What did that mean to you? I mean, you were a talented. I mean, people were recognizing your talent, and you were still a young man. Mm-hmm. And what did that mean to you when someone like Jackie Robinson broke into the majors?
Well, it mean just like Joe Louis was a boxer. He was the greatest black boxer with Sugar Ray Robinson. Jackie broke in and. When he broke in, it was like we know we can get to the majors just we ever had a chance. And for 2 years, Jackie had to be very patient. You know, and he couldn't fight, he couldn't do anything. And when he came in, if you notice, black players began to come in very quickly. So that's why we admire Jackie so much, because we know the hardships that he had in each town that he went to. So what it means to me that, hey, I think I'm going to make a good living if I just keep on playing. And we recognize that in Jackie Robinson.
I think you said about him that he was the first who didn't pretend not to be black.
Very much so. Jackie was a man that knew that he was black, and no one could tell him anything different. He spoke very, very well. He was well educated coming out of California, I think, or UCLA. And he was the type of guy that when you start talking black and white, he's always there. He was the type of guy who would fight for the blacks all the time, you know. So, yes, I would have to say that.
I would think in those days, and it's true to a certain extent in these days, that it's dangerous to be black and proud. I mean, that he had to had to walk a very fine line because...
You mean in these days?
Well, I was thinking mostly in those days.
Oh, okay. In those days. Well, I don't know. I was a positive thinker all my life, but I know what you're saying because when I came to the majors, we couldn't stay with the whites, so we had to stay in different hotels. But I was the guy hitting the home runs, so I knew... even though I was hitting the home runs, that they had a problem as far as race was concerned. But again, I was programmed before I got here, so it didn't bother me that much to come to the majors and not being able to, you know, to stay with the people.
How did you get the nickname, the Say Hey Kid?
Well, that's when I first came up in 1951, and I didn't know any of the guys' names, and I would start calling them Say Hey, and I started hitting home runs, and the different people around the country started calling me Say Hey, and the writers just gave me the Say Hey Kid, and it just stuck with me all these years.
Do you like the name?
Well, if I didn't, I wouldn't use it.
You, I know, had a very impressive batting average in the minors, and it was 477, and the major leagues got interested in you, and... Mm. When the Giants called you, you turned them down. You said,
"No, I didn't turn them down." I told Leo. He called me in a place called Sioux City, Iowa. You don't turn people down like when they call you up. You make suggestions.
Okay.
You know, like I said to Leo, "I don't think I want to come up. I think I would like to stay in the mound to see what I can do for the whole year." But they had lost 13 out of 14 games, and they needed a refreshing guy to come up. And he said, "Well, if you're hitting 477 here, can you hit 250? I said, "Yeah, I can hit that." So he convinced me that they needed me here. But you don't do that when you're in the minors. When they call you up, you should be ready to come and play, regardless of what you play. You got to be there.
Well, when you started playing in the majors, you were a young man. You were 20 years old, and
I just turned 20 when I came to the majors. In New York, actually, my first game was here in Philadelphia, and I was on a Friday, and I played three games here and didn't do that well, but we won all three games, and that's the bottom line, win. And they didn't bother me, but I was getting upset myself. And when I went back to the clubhouse, I was all upset, and Leo gave me a lot of confidence in playing center field, and he said to me that as long as I'm here or you here, you're going to be my center fielder. And I think that helped me tremendous to take a little load off my shoulders, you know, about going back to the minors I'm talking about, you know. So I think he played a great deal of a part in me, you know, being in baseball.
Do you think of him as a sort of father-son relationship? Because I think...
He was.
Yeah, that he certainly thought of you as his son and had...
Well, he and Lorraine Day, which was a movie star at that time, taking me in their homes many times. His kid, Chris DeRocha, used to be my roommate on the road, and they would bring him to New York and leave him with me for like two weeks. And I used to take him on the road, eat what I used to eat, and he didn't like it sometimes, but that's the way it was. You know, he would go back and tell his father I didn't feed him or something, and then that way his father would give us extra money so we can have a steak or something. So it worked out fine for me, you know.
My guest is baseball great Willie Mays. There were several people, several men, several managers that really took an interest in you. What did they see in you? I mean, you were obviously a great baseball player, but did they see perhaps...
You mean before I started? I mean, see, it wasn't a lot of managers bother me after Leo. They might have taken an interest in me, but they couldn't show me nothing. I was very, I would say I had a sixth sense of doing everything my own way, but it might have been a unique type of way. But after Leo, I didn't have a lot of manager take an interest in me, if you're talking about showing me what to do and how to do it. Herman Franks was a guy that said to me, okay, you can take care of the field. That means I manage the field, I manage the bench. And Alvin Dock made me the first black captain of the ball club. So when you say interest, it's not like Leo took an interest in me. It was a combination type of thing. Okay, I'm going to make you the captain. And the press played it up because I was the first black. And Herman knew that I could handle the field much better than he, and he let me do that. So that was the interest that they'd taken part of in.
Where did you learn the basket catch?
I learned that when I was in the service. I was in the service 52-53, and I really didn't have that much to do. I was like a PT instructor or whatever. You know, I didn't do much of that either because I played ball every day. We had a schedule of about 90 games, and I said to myself, I need to have something when I come back to the game, and I tried the basket catch, and when I came back, they started calling it the bread basket catch. So I said, oh, no, that's not what I call it. So we used it just a basket catch. And I found out that I could do more that way than I could over my shoulders. But that is not the correct way of catching a baseball. You know, I wouldn't teach that way.
Well, I would think part of the problem or part of what you have to contend with is you don't see the ball going into your glove.
You don't want to see the ball go in your glove because you got your head's got to be up when you catch that. See, I couldn't teach that to you. Because it was something very unusual that I would do, and if you didn't practice at it, you try to watch the ball in the glove. You don't watch it. You watch it when it goes by the eye level, and when it goes by, you don't just look down because if you do, you lose all sight on what you're going to do and how you're going to throw it. So it's a very difficult thing to do.
Is it also easier somehow from that position to then toss the ball, to throw the ball where you want to throw it?
Well, it's got to be what I call one piece. The ball, as you know, downgrade. And when you downgrade, you just bring it around all in the same one motion. But it's, like I say, it's very difficult for me to try and explain to you or tell you because it was a very unusual type of catching, you know.
But somehow it fit your physique or the way that you played the game.
I made it fit. I made it fit, and I found out it was easier for me to do it than to catch it above my shoulder.
I suppose your fans still remember about your catch in the 1954 World Series.
Yeah, they talk about that because it was in the World Series, and I think that was a turning point in 1954 when we had the World Series, and I think people still talk about it because a lot of people were there, and it was the World Series. And I think when they do talk about it, it keeps me going a lot of times as far as visibility. And I made better catches than that during the course of a season. But, of course, nobody saw it because we didn't have that much television in those days. But this was in the World Series, and thousands of people saw the game.
Well, what you did was to kind of catch the ball over your shoulder.
Well, it's not that easy. See,
no, I know that.
You sometimes think about catching just a ball over your shoulder. I didn't catch it that way. It was a lot of things happening all in one motion where you got to catch the ball, throw the ball, and you got to throw it on target to a certain base. That's a whole three pieces there where you got to do. And first, you got to catch the ball. Then you got to throw it. Then you got to think. As you running, and that's what I did. As I'm running, I'm thinking what I'm going to do with this ball before I ever catch it. And if I miss it, then you got to think about that too. So you got to think as you're running what you're going to do.
But you don't think that was your greatest catch?
No. Well, I made better catches than that. You know.
One thing you did, which I find is interesting, and to me sort of plays into the dramatic elements that baseball has. I mean, baseball is a sport, but to me it's also a very dramatic kind of thing. You're watching the way these guys play on the field. And you used to wear a cap that was too big for your head.
Too small.
Too small for your
head.
Not
too big, too small. The reason for that is that I was an entertainer. And when you are an entertainer, you try and do things that people understand and they relate to you. They related the cap, the catch, and the base running all to myself because I did something different. I wasn't just an ordinary base runner, ordinary guy in the field catching the ball. And I, every time I ran, my cap would fly off. And one time I was catching the ball and catching my hat all at the same time. So you have to understand that the writers look for things like that, and they write it the way they see it.
But is it also a way of controlling the game, I mean, the pace of the game, because you'd have to go back and pick up your hat.
No, we had guys for that.
You had guys who could do that for you?
The guy that comes behind me, he's supposed to do that. Sometimes I would leave it and then bring it back, you know, because the guys would pick it up, for me.
You many times really collapsed from exhaustion.
Yes.
I mean, you played with your body and soul, with your whole self. Were people afraid that you were going to burn out?
Well, no, I had no problem about burning out. That's the way I played. I played 22 years, and I asked the doctor a couple of times, why was I falling out? And that's what he gave me. It was fatigue, mainly. Every year I would fall out around July, and they would send me to the hospital and give me all kinds of vitamins and B12s and things and get myself back together. If you look at the stats or statistics on my playing ability each year, you will see that the most games I miss, maybe two, maybe three games a year, and that's not a lot of game out of 154 or 162 games. So when the doctor explained to me that it's fatigue, then I didn't worry no more because I knew it was coming. But when you're in a pennant race, they couldn't afford not to have me on the ball club or on the field. So I had to play until I fell out, and when I fell out, they dragged me out and put me in the hospital, and that's it.
My guest is baseball great Willie Mays. We're going to talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Willie Mays, one of the most all-round players in the history of baseball. In his 22 seasons in the major leagues, he played in all 21 All-Star games, batted over 300, and hit 660 home runs. His autobiography, Say Hey, has just been published. When the Giants moved out to San Francisco in 1957, the San Francisco fans were cool to you. In fact, I think there was an article in the paper that said that they cheered Khrushchev and booed Willie Mays.
Yeah.
How hard was that for you, or what was that like for you to play in a place that was not as warm to you, perhaps, as your fans and critics and sports writers in New York were?
That didn't bother me.
No.
If you look at the stats in 1958, I had one of my best seasons. I hit 348. I hit 29 home runs. That to me, I was trying to tell them, hey, you don't bother me. I'm going to play my game regardless. But I didn't feel that they had to boo me. That was my hometown people. And I felt that whatever they did, they got to be with me. It taken me 2 years to win them over, and I really didn't think I had to because what they were saying to me, you coming from New York, now show me, which I had played already in the major. I have shown a lot of people that I could play baseball, and I don't know the reason for that, you know, and I really don't talk about it that much because that's in the past. I still live in San Francisco, and I think I'm going to stay there. But it was just one of those things, I think. They wasn't used to Major League Baseball. They was used to the Coast League at all times. And when a Major League club came out, especially a guy like myself, better than Joe the manager, which was live in the city, and he was my idol, but they didn't, you know, stop to find out. Didn't bother me at all to say, hey, we're going to pick Alanis Zepeda for the most favored player in the first year. And I didn't say nothing. I just went on and played my game. Next year, I had a better year. So you can't continue doing misusing a guy that's playing every day and playing good. So that's what happened.
You know. Well, you played for yourself then. I mean, you didn't.
No. I didn't play for myself. I played. Myself was easy. The other eight guys, it wasn't easy because sometimes you have to tell each guy in different position what to do and how to do it because sometimes they get nervous and you got to know who gets nervous and not. Same as a hitter. You got to know what he can hit and what he can't hit. A pitcher know what to throw and when to try and hit it. So I myself never really got excited too much when I played baseball, you know.
You talk about Candlestick Park out there and the wind and how you had to really readjust for the wind.
Not me. I had a beat. I played center field very well in San Francisco. I was there to actually people that came into the ballpark had a problem, not me. I would have a beat. Like, for instance, in San Francisco, if you hit a ball to left center, it was a count there, one, two, three, four, five. And the ball, by the time you get to move, the ball is coming down to you. But certain guys came out of another climate, they would go to the ball where they think the ball was going to be. But the wind blew so hard that it would blow it to right center without any problem. And that's why they had problems. They didn't know how the wind would blow, and they didn't know what to do and how to play it. You know?
So you would watch the ball count and see where the wind would take it, and then you knew where to go.
I knew where to go before the ball that was hit. So you can't wait all that. That's too long. You gotta move, and you gotta move on time. You know, if you don't play the center field, these are things I'm telling you are very difficult to understand because you don't have a knack of saying to yourself, well, gee, I'm gonna count 1, 2, 3. That's not that way you play. You count 1, 2, 3 and just move slowly. Mm-hmm. But you're watching the ball all the same time, and it's gonna blow where you stop counting that. And most people, if they count, they're going to go to the ball, and the ball is never going to come. They're going to be where they just left.
One thing I know that all sports players have to contend with is when to retire. And I think mm-hmm. what is difficult about sports players is that perhaps when you're in your prime, perhaps mentally, I think that when we're 35, we all sort of hit our stride. Oftentimes for sports players, they're not in their prime when it comes to their body. And I was wondering how you dealt with that, how you knew when to retire or when not to retire.
First of all, you don't know.
You don't.
I think most players try to play as long as they can, and I think they should. I was told that I played too long my last 2 years. I don't think so.
You don't think so?
Well, I think I enjoyed the game as much as when I was 19, but I couldn't play the game as well as I was 19. But I said to the writers and many times, I played for 22 years, now you got to give me 2 years.
Hmm.
So they did, and I always thank them because I didn't have the opportunity to play like I should. Plus, I was traded. I think if I had stayed with the Giants, I wouldn't have had no problem playing. The new environment, when you go there, you try so hard to do something for your new ball club, but the body won't let you do it. So if I had stayed with San Francisco, I could have played 3 or 4 games a week, and I would have had no problem playing. But it was just one of those things. And I think I played as long as I wanted to play. And I think you see guys now playing up to 45, 40 without any problem. And nobody's saying nothing.
Hmm.
But they're making money, which I think they should play as long as they can, as long as they enjoy the game, as long as the people sign them.
When you retired from baseball, you began to work for Bally's.
No. When I retired, I stayed with the Mets for 5 years. And then after the fifth year, I was approached by Al Rosen and a guy named Mr. Billy Weinberger. Mm-hmm. And that was in 79. And they asked me, would I come to Atlantic City? And I said, I have to check with the commissioner because, as you know, gambling and baseball doesn't, you know, go together too cool. And
Bowie Kuhn was the commissioner back
Bowie
then.
Bowie Kuhn was the commissioner then, and he ruled that I had to leave baseball to go to Atlantic City, in which I didn't think it was right. But then when you look at it, he is the commissioner, and he had the right to say whatever he wanted. Still, I often tell him that wasn't right because I was only going there to do the PR work because in gambling, they don't need me to gamble. They're going to gamble anyway. You know?
Well, I think he was afraid that somehow your image would somehow tarnish, I suppose, the image of other baseball players because you were associated with...
No, that's not so because we had been going to Vegas 7 years, going to the Dooms Hotel and playing in golf tournaments the same as I do when I go to Atlantic City. So that was no trying to tell a ball player what to do. They're going to do what they want to do anyway.
Sure.
And I said to the commissioner that we've been going. He said, well, I know that. I said, well, then is this the same thing I'm going to do? I'm just getting paid for it. So he ruled that I couldn't go, and I think I just, you know, left it at that and didn't bother with it. Then when Peter Uberoff came in, he said the same thing that I said. Why shouldn't you be able to make a living if you're not doing anything wrong? I like to know what I'm doing. So he called, and they assured him that I wasn't involved in gambling. They don't need me for that. They need me to play golf with the people and maybe go to dinner with people sometime and just do the PR work.
In 1979, you were inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And you said at the time, I think I was the best baseball player I ever saw.
No. That was a reason for that. That was a guy that was a writer, and I was talking, and this was in New York. And they kept asking me, who's the best baseball? So I ignored him for about, 5 minutes. And all of a sudden in my mind, what do you use for a headline? Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, the headline is going to be Willie Mays says he's the best baseball player in the world. And that's the reason I said it. Never have I said that again, because I don't do that. That's not my style of talking. But I looked at a headline. I knew what the headline was going to be the next day before it came out. And I said to the writer, would you repeat what you said, sir? He said, well, then who's the best baseball player? And I said, Willie Mays. Mm. And right away, the next headline, because I knew what they were looking for. You know, they didn't have a headline, see. But I never really talk about myself when it comes to playing, because I think the fans do that enough for themselves.
What do you miss about baseball?
I don't miss anything about baseball. I played 22 years. I enjoy what I did, and I think I did it well. And I don't try and look back. I don't try to pick up time. I think when you try and look back, you worry too much. And I know I worry about baseball. It took me 2 years to get off of the field. And now I don't want to have to start worrying all over again about it. So I don't look back. I don't even watch films of myself. It just reminds me of too much of getting back on the field, so I try and stay away from it as much as I can. Yeah.
Well, Willie Mays, I thank you very much for talking with us today.
Sure, thank you very much.
My guest has been baseball great Willie Mays, one of the best players in the history of baseball. His autobiography, Say Hey, has just been published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.